This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Jet Setters Show, where we explore lifestyle-friendly destinations worldwide. Enjoy and learn from a variety of experts on topics ranging from upscale travel at wholesale prices to retiring overseas, to global real estate and business opportunities, to tax havens and expatriate opportunities. You'll get great ideas on unique cultures, causes, and cruise vacations. Whether you're wealthy or just want to live a wealthy lifestyle, the Jet Setter Show is for you. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Terrence Gillespie to the show. He has worked at IBM, GE, UCLA. He's played jazz piano on cruise ships. He's an instrument-rated pilot, a businessman, a songwriter, author of the upcoming book, The Outlier's Handbook. He's attempting to optimize every aspect of life, one article at a time. He'll give out his website later in the show. He's got a BS in computer science with a minor in music from the University of Florida. What he's here to talk to us about today is a fascinating story about a development called Galt's Gulch. Those of you who are familiar with Ayn Rand, the very prolific author and author of The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, many, many other books that, by the way, are fantastic, might recall from Atlas Shrugged, the book or the movie series, Galt's Gulch. And that's what we're here to talk about today, this development in Chile, maybe some possible improper dealings that went on there. Terrence, welcome. How are you?
Fantastic. How are you, Jason? Good morning.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So Galt's Gulch, your story is really interesting. I guess you got married, you were looking for maybe a possible second choice country in which to live or maybe move someday, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. 8 years ago I got married and I said, hey, I want to live in a beautiful place and I'd also like to have an alternative place in the United States and one alternative country outside of the United States. Went through all 190 of them, the ones that are calling themselves sovereign states nowadays, came up with three. Chile was number two, and got very serious about vetting Chile. Just fell in love with it because it's very similar to Northern California. Just a beautiful place.
Uh-huh. Good stuff. So you're in Northern California now.
Yes.
Okay. So you were looking for this secondary option, and it sounds like your choices were, I guess, Switzerland was your first choice, Chile was your second choice, and Colombia was your third, right?
That's exactly right. Yes.
Okay. So you went down to Chile. You spent some time there, and how do you hear about this Galt's Gulch development, this real estate deal there being promoted? It's being promoted, by the way, was being promoted very heavily on the internet. I saw it a lot of places.
Well, amazingly enough, the first time I was there with my wife, we had lunch in the Coracaví area. If we had decided to stop by at the time, we couldn't have because there was no Galt's Gulch Chile in 2011. I heard about it when I was with my son for 2 months down in Colombia. And I was looking at a website and caught my eye. One of the libertarian websites described Galt's Gulch Chile. And having just been there, I was just fascinated with it and read all about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's what happened. Now, what did you discover about Galt's Gulch? I mean, I guess when you heard about it, you did some investigation, some looking around. I mean, tell the story.
Well, at that point, I had been down there with a friend of mine for about 21 days, and we vetted the entire country of Chile. That was my second trip. And so I was just intimately familiar, having read John Coben's books about the entire country, and I just was just fascinated and fell in love with the country. And so I was interested to see where exactly, what location would be chosen for this. And it was an excellent location. And I see the reason for that excellent choice was because Coben, who's been there for about 20 years, made that choice. And so I was interested to see where it was and then just got drawn into it. I really had no idea that anything had gone wrong with the project until when Wendy McElroy's articles came out. And of course, that got me even more fascinated with it.
Okay. So now, who is, well, John Coben, what books did he write? I'm not familiar with him. He wrote about Chile, I guess.
A Life in Chile. Okay. I think he's been down there since 1995 with his five kids. He is the libertarian guy down there. So I thought when I was planning my second trip with my friend down there for 21 days, I had read Coben's book and it enabled me to get, you know, three trips out of that one trip because I had known so much. And we were able to plan a detailed itinerary and, you know, X out some of the areas we knew we wouldn't be interested in and I'll tell you, by the time we left Chile on that second trip, my buddy and I had specific airports, schools for my children, the exact locations that we would choose. So it was a very productive trip.
Okay, so, and then who is Wendy McElroy?
She is a libertarian writer. She's got a website, WendyMcElroy.com, and I frequently read some of her news stories and her articles and just enjoy her take on things, and was fascinated to see that she and her husband had purchased an option on a lot down in Gulch Gulch, Chile. Periodically, she was writing about it and what they were going through, learning Spanish, preparing for the trip. And I just got drawn into that story because it could have been me. And I thought, hey, it might be me. And so, yeah.
Okay. So tell us how it developed with Gulch Gulch then and what you discovered.
Well, what I discovered is that it was just all unraveling. And I just couldn't figure out why, because it seemed that the people involved were very respectable. I mean, Coben's name was involved with it. Jeff Berwick's name from the Dollar Vigilante was involved with it. Wendy McElroy had made a decision to purchase a lot. So you're talking about some very high-profile people here. And that a project they would be involved with would go wrong was just drew me into this. And I thought, what could have possibly happened with this?
So they lended their names to the project then, I guess, right? This is a real estate development, a subdivision deal, right?
Yeah, it's a real estate development deal in Coracaví, Chile, which is between Valparaíso and Santiago.
Okay, and so they bought some land, and then they were subdividing it and selling lots, right? I don't think they were selling any actual completed homes, were they?
No, and you have to clarify they right off the bat, because the way it unfolded is four people got together. It was all John Coben's idea. He brought Jeff Berwick down to raise some capital for the project. They signed a partnership agreement with four people, one of them being Kenneth Johnson, Jeff Berwick, John Coben, and Ezia Weir. And the idea was to use the entity that they started shortly thereafter to start developing and take title to the land that John had found.
Okay.
So that's how it got started.
Okay, so who's John? Who purchased the land or bought that or found the land, I guess?
Okay, well, they formed an entity quickly there after that. Mm-hmm. About 20 to 30 days later, Ken Johnson, who was the least known of all these people, had cut everybody out of the deal, started his own personal entity, and took title of the land that Coben had found for them and negotiated a fantastic price, and proceeded to cut everybody out of the deal. It was quite shocking to the other three, but for a long time, including the investors who paid for that first purchase, which was done, about 30 days later, they didn't know that Johnson had cut them out.
Okay. So name the parties again who started this. I just want to make sure everybody can follow this.
Sure. The first four partners were John Coben, Jeff Berwick, I think it's Herman Eziaguirre, Coben's partner, and Kenneth Dale Johnson.
Okay, so those were the four original founders of this project, you're saying, right?
That's correct, okay. With the largest founder being John Coben himself. And Jeff Berwick and Johnson, they learned about this deal from Coben. The only reason Coben reached out to them at all is because he suspected that Jeff Berwick could bring in capital for the project, that is, investors. So when Johnson and Berwick, who had never stepped foot in Chile, but upon the wheels of the jet plane hitting the tarmac, within hours, they were hooked up by John Coben to what could have been the largest deal of their lives. And they could do that so quickly because Coben had already written the business plan, had already scouted the property, and he was just ready to go. All he needed was somebody to raise capital. Mm-hmm. Jeff Berwick fulfilled that promise of potentially being able to raise capital. He did indeed do so. The problem is that...
Do you know how much he raised?
Well, there were 76 investors / buyers of property in all. And so far, $10 million has been put into the property. So,
okay. And then what happened? So,
well, as I said, very quickly thereafter, Johnson, they cut them all out of the deal. Although the investors didn't know that, started his own personal entity, and then, without doing any due diligence for the first property, proceeded to purchase it with investor money, generated by Berwick and took title into his own personal entity.
Okay, so how do you know that that happened? What is the evidence for that?
Because at this point, Jason, of course, nobody would have known this at start, and most of the investors didn't know that for a long time, and even some of the principals didn't know that. But at this point, I've done so much digging, and I've gotten so many documents that are publicly available in Chile through the court office, and I've pieced things together. I have a very detailed timeline and references in my 7-part series on Gulch, Chile. The first part of that series is extremely detailed about what transpired, and I was just able to slowly zero in
Tell the listeners about that series. When you say series, do you mean a series of blog articles?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and where can they find those?
You can find it on my website, mickgillespie.com, so mcgillespie.com.
Okay.
There's a little box there. It'll say Gulch, Chile series, and you can easily find all 7. I'm adding to them. But there you go. So,
all right. Okay. Sounds good. So what else happened? So he bamboozled the other investors, you're saying, the other partners, right?
He did indeed. Yes.
Okay. By kind of stealing it out from under them. And what did this mean to the buyers and the consumers? I mean, investors are sort of thought of as people who, they're big kids, in other words,
yep.
Right? They should kind of be ready for stuff like this to happen. But just the regular consumers that were home buyers, maybe they need a little more protection, right?
Yes, I would say the biggest thing that happened from the buyer's point of view is there was a material omission of the people involved. They all believed that Jeff Berwick and John Coben were involved. Those were the biggest names. Those are the only names that people know. It's probably still the only names that people know. They would have there's a lot of goodwill associated with those names, especially John Coben and to a lesser extent Berwick. But they were able to attract people would think that they were involved in the project and say, wow, hey, if these guys have vetted this property, I'll bet it's a really good thing. They would never know that those principals that attracted them to the property had already been cut out by the time they even went down there to check out the land.
Mm-hmm. But did these guys really vet the property, or were they just marketers looking to collect a check for raising money or something, you know?
Oh, well, John Coben thoroughly vetted the property.
Okay.
Yes, very thoroughly.
So how did this happen then if he vetted it? I mean, I guess not really just vetting the property, but vetting the deal, the whole structure, everything, right?
Well, if I focus on Coben for a minute, he's been to every city in Chile, I think, except 2. He's been there for 20 years, lived down there on and off for 20 years, so very familiar with it. Finally chose what really is an optimal location. If you want to get a bunch of libertarians together and have very convenient access to some beautiful land by the vineyards and very close to Santiago, but not too close, about 45 minutes away from Santiago, wow, Curacafé is definitely the answer. Now, it gets a little bit more murky when I say thoroughly vetted, because there were a couple of things wrong with the first property. Gulch, Chile consists of 2 properties. The first one is El Peñón. The second one is El Lepe. The first property that was purchased was El Peñón. There were 2 things wrong with El Peñón that had to be corrected in order for it to be a viable property for many people to live in. The first and primary one is water rights. Part of the original delivery of Coben and Ezeaguirre for property number 1 El Peñón was to inscribe and consolidate the water rights so that the land could be further subdivided beyond its current limitation of 12 into a viable property where multiple 100 people could share that property. However, they could not follow through on that promise because Johnson had cut them out of the deal so quickly, wouldn't return their phone calls. And then shortly thereafter, the first thing Coben knew, he was being accused in the media of having recommended a bum property, which he did not.
Who was being accused of that? Johnson?
John Coben was being accused.
Coben. Okay, all right, got it.
By Johnson. So Johnson was essentially accusing Coben of not following through on something that he wouldn't let Coben follow through because he cut him out of the deal and wouldn't return his phone calls.
Right, okay.
There's an additional thing that had to be a challenge for El Peñón that had to be overcome, and I hear that there were environmental restrictions that had to be relieved. I'm less familiar with all that kind of stuff. However, the key to all of the land development obstacles being removed was always Coben and Ezeaguirre, because they speak fluent Spanish, are intimately familiar with the local courts, know the development process, were very excited about inscribing and consolidating those water rights. They just couldn't get access to the land because Johnson had cut them out. So we may never know if Coben and Ezequiel would have been 100% successful in removing those obstacles. All we know now is that Johnson accuses them of selling, you know, recommending a bum piece of land to them, which they didn't. They recommended a perfect piece of land in a great country for the deal, were enthusiastic about removing those obstacles to for development, and were simply cut out of the deal before they could do so.
Wow. Okay. So who got burned here? Like, who are all the different parties that got burned?
The first person to get burned was Coben. He had negotiated a $250,000 finders and business plan fee, and also for that same money had agreed to inscribe and consolidate the water rights with his partner. And there was a certain percentage of each sale that he was going to be due. So he's the first one that got burned. Thereafter, it is difficult to find any party, whether they be an investor or a partner, other than Johnson, that has not gotten burned. So I would say all other parties, depending on the when they delivered their money, what they expected. Perhaps you would say the third person to get burned would be Jeff Berwick, because he had a verbal agreement that he was 50-50 partners with Johnson, but did not know that Johnson was soon to remove his name from the entity, Johnson's personal entity. And so Berwick, for a long time, was marketing this deal in full swing, not even knowing that he had been cut out of the deal.
Wow. Okay. All right. Okay. And what about the buyers? How many people bought property in the development?
In total, eventually 76. However, as in most deals, a lot of the money is, the preponderance of the money was in maybe the first 10. So they lost significant chunks of money. I'm going to just ballpark it and say $400,000 to $700,000 each, perhaps, very general, of the first 10.
So how did they lose that money? They bought properties, and it sounds like, yes, maybe what happened, and I'm just speculating here, that they mm-hmm. purchased properties from an entity that didn't mm-hmm. own the properties. Is that because the entity got, you know, basically got the land stolen out from mm-hmm. under it by Johnson, I think you said,
yes,
right? Yeah.
Yes, that's basically correct. I mean, the land was owned by an entity, but it wasn't owned by the entity that the investors thought it was owned by. They were
right. And when you say investors, let's distinguish investors versus home buyers. Okay. Is there a distinction there?
No, I can safely say investors here at this point, because at this point, no home buyers have come in to try to look at individual lots. These are investors.
Oh, okay. So these are all people that were investing in the development company, not in purchasing specific lots in the development.
Yes.
As a real estate investor,
yes,
right?
But in return for their initial investment, they were guaranteed first choice of the lots and a certain percentage of the lemon orchards and income that was promised to them if they were part of the first four. And then there was a second round of founders. So there were promises. They were going to get their first choice of a lot in which to build on anyway. Mm-hmm. But they were also get income generated through various means, purported various means from the property, lemon trees, water rights, all sorts of other uses for the property that would supposedly generate an income.
Okay. All right. So, wow, this is amazing. Okay. So what happened to the money? I mean, they took that, the three partners really that were mm-hmm. left, Berwick and the two others, is Azwari, or I can't even think of the name, say it.
Ezequiel.
And who's the third one?
Berwick, Coben, Ezequiel.
Oh, and Coben, Johnson. Of course. Coben, sorry. Can't yeah. forget Coben. He's the biggest name of all. Okay, so those people took the money, it sounds like, from these investors, but they just didn't know that the land had been stolen out from under them. So why didn't they just give the money back to the investors?
I mean, at this, you've just made a very common and understandable mistake there, Jason.
Right.
The theft happened so quickly that the investors didn't know that all of the partners of the four had been cut out except Johnson, because Johnson cut them out. So when they
Johnson had the money, then, it sounds like you're going to say?
What happened is Berwick was very successful in generating the money. These guys were reading very enthusiastic articles written by Jeff Berwick on the dollar vigilante. They were staring at pictures that Berwick put in the articles, and they were saying, "This is fantastic." I know if you know Coben's involved, Berwick's involved. He's enthusiastic, and they didn't even know the name Johnson. So they sent their money looking at a picture of Berwick and knowing about Coben, and said, "This is going to be great." They sent their money down, not knowing that they were transferring money into the pockets of somebody they didn't even know, Johnson.
Yeah.
So they were able. The marketing was completely disconnected from the reality of where of what the money was purchasing, and that continued to be the case for maybe 6 or 7 months. People were very enthusiastic about this project. Jeff Berwick thought it might be successful, but had no idea how successful it was going to be. The money just poured in. And, you know, I guess a metaphor would be you're staring at a picture of person number one and you write a check and you don't realize that it went to person number four. Like, oh, how did that happen? I thought I was buying this picture. But by the time the person invested, Johnson had cut everybody out of the deal. So the money didn't go where the initial investors had every reason to believe that it was going.
Where's Johnson now? What happened to him? Or does anybody know? Well, did he just disappear with the money or what?
He did disappear with the money for a while. Last October, as you can imagine, when you have 76 people who've given $10 million, they get upset when their phone calls are not returned.
Yeah, I'd hope so.
Eventually, they did fly themselves down to Chile and they entered the property looking for Johnson. It turns out that Johnson was hiding in the bushes.
You're kidding. Like, are you serious?
Oh, Jason, you can't make up.
Wow, this is like Saddam Hussein and hiding in that hole, you know.
Very much so. Wow. Very much so.
Okay.
You just can't make up some of the real things that have happened here. So the investors enter the property. I'm, five or six of them. And looking for Johnson.
When you say entered the property, I mean they entered a huge, massive piece of land with many acres, right?
Yes, but there was a hacienda, and there's several places to stay in the hacienda. There's an office.
Okay.
There are farm materials and grounds and stuff. There's places to stay. There's an office there and everything.
Okay, so he happened to be there. Tell what happened.
Well,
how many of the investors came? They all flew down together.
I'm going to ballpark this. I'm thinking it was six in all.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So they enter the property and they ask the very realistic question to the farm workers. Have you seen Ken Johnson?
Right.
And it takes them, it takes hours. I think eventually Johnson shows up that night or the next day, but it takes them hours to figure out that he's been hiding in the bushes the whole time.
Oh, my God.
And if you can, as I said, you can't make this stuff up. Here we have a very complicated land development deal happening in Chile, and Johnson doesn't even speak Spanish or read Spanish. So he needs to walk around with a translator at the hip. His name is Ian Thornton, just to figure out what people are telling him.
His translator is Ian Thornton. Okay.
Yes. And so he sends his translator to the investors on the property to try to figure out what's going on. And they say, "Look, we just want to talk to the guy. Where is he?" And it just doesn't go well. This was later. Terribly and inaccurately described as a raid. It was not a raid. It was simply investors who paid for property entering their own land. But of course, you can't really say that that's true because Johnson had taken title to the property in his own corporate entity.
Yeah. So it really wasn't their land because they were swindled, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, so you have to make this moral, legal stipulation every time you speak about the thing.
Yeah, well, it should have been their own land is what you're saying, right?
Okay. Yes, morally it was their land because they paid for it. Legally, it wasn't, so it just gets so murky. And now things get even more murky, if you can believe it.
Okay, go for it.
But I won't do that. But what I want to point out to your listeners and to yourself is that almost everything you read about Gulch Chile nowadays, I guess including in my series, happened downstream of the initial theft. The initial theft took place in the first 30 to 45 days.
Okay.
It was so efficient. It was so quick. It was so alarming. It was so bold. It was so immoral. It was so unpredictable. It was so outrageous that people couldn't believe it.
Right.
And some very smart people spent the next 11 months trying to figure out what exactly happened here.
Okay.
And it's only with that information that I can tell you this complete story now. It certainly wasn't obvious to the people as they were going through it what had happened.
Yeah, hindsight's 20/20, as they say.
Yes.
So, what is your involvement here? I mean, I gotta just ask, like,
sure.
What's your motivation in doing this? Are you being paid anything? Do these people advertise with you or anything like that? Or
no,
you know, is there any connection? Or are you just kind of interested in this? Tell us.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm a libertarian writer. As I said, you know, I finally got to the point where I could maybe afford a place outside the country, vetted the whole world. And then, son of a gun, if I don't see a creature invading one of the most beautiful places in one of the countries that I chose. And to make matters worse, I think what got me interested in the project is trying to untaint libertarianism with what had occurred.
Yeah, but libertarianism's not tainted, right? Well, you know, let me say a couple of things, and, you know, I'd love to get your comments on them. First of all, the Galt's Gulch thing, I never really understood what the big deal was about it. I mean, they sort of marketed as though, I mean, I remember seeing Jeff Berwick's videos on it and so forth. I'm not saying he said this, okay? I mean, Jeff Berwick is a friend of mine. I know who the guy is. I mean, he's not like a close friend, but I know him, and I think he's a nice guy. I'll put it that way, okay? But, you know, it's like it was being marketed as though these people are setting up their own individual sovereign libertarian government.
Right.
It wasn't that at all. It's just a development in a country that for the last decade or so has skewed more to the libertarian side. I mean, big deal. Like, I didn't get the big deal. Okay. So, you know, because you put that wrapper on it, it's going to, you're going to charge 50% more than just buying another piece of land in Chile or, you know, I really didn't get it. It just did not strike a chord with me. And I love libertarianism.
Yeah.
You know, I love the message that some of these guys are putting out there, but what's the big angle? So what? You live with a bunch of libertarians. You don't have any slackers. You're still paying taxes to the Chilean government or the US government because you have to declare all worldwide income, right? I mean, what's the big thing?
Okay. Well, you're revealing your sophistication, Jason. Okay. You know, you have I can tell that you know a lot about real estate. You're very savvy in the world. So, however, I will say that the link between libertarianism and this fiasco was being made, and my evidence is the first six articles that came out about Galt's Gulch, Chile, and the negative things that were going on with them were just waiting to bash either Ayn Rand, who I'm no I'm no apologist for Ayn Rand. But they were just waiting to bash her book, and they were just waiting to bash libertarianism, and they just couldn't wait to accuse people who like to be free and of just not being able to deal with each other. I mean, that was what the sentiment that I learned was in the media.
Well, I mean, you know, so what? So Democrats have disputes amongst each other all the time. Republicans have disputes. The Green Party people sue each other. Everybody defrauds each other in every ethnicity and political party and ideology. I say big deal to that. But I don't know. I don't think it's an indictment against libertarianism at all. But that said, what is the role of the government here? I mean, certainly the U.S. government's going to say, we don't care, unless he was promoting the properties here, which I guess you may be able to argue that. But what about the Chilean government? Did they step in? Is there any government help here for these libertarians?
It's funny because
Ayn Rand said the one thing the government should do, well, not just the one thing, but is they should have a court system so disputes can be settled without violence.
Yes. Know? How ironic. Well, you know, it's very interesting you bring up jurisdiction because depending on who you ask, I mean, I will tell you what I think is the real story, but depending on who you ask, you can cite jurisdiction in Chile, the United States, because the preponderance of investors were from the United States, or you could go with England or New Zealand because the entities that they had created to take title to the land were New Zealand trusts. And in those contracts, it said that New Zealand had the jurisdiction. And so once you do that, you're separating enforcement with the country of origin, which is Chile, with jurisdiction, which is New Zealand, which was part of the trust that held one of the entities that owned the land. And so jurisdiction gets very murky.
This is one of the reasons I think there's so many scam artists in the world of international expat, this and that, you know, libertarian ideology, because there's no jurisdiction. I mean, I remember going to a conference in Belize, which is a third world country I wouldn't want to live in. But, you know, it's being promoted by libertarians all the time, like it's some great place. And I also had John McAfee on my show, who would really argue with that quite a bit. And he provided a lot of evidence about Belize. And the
I followed all that. That was just as fascinating as Gulch Chile.
You're definitely right about that. Yeah. But all these guys were there promoting, not all these guys, but some of them were promoting these crap investments, these crap projects, a condo tell in Panama. And I just know that even if that was in the U.S., it'd still be a crappy investment, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you just have no enforcement, because it's funny that most of these promoters that talk about international everything, they all live in the U.S., or at least they have a home in the U.S.
Yep.
They haven't relinquished their citizenship. They're kind of full of crap, a lot of these guys. I mean, honestly, they really are.
Well, as you know,
I've had them on my show, you know, and I'm nice to them and I think it's interesting. I mean, look, I started a whole podcast around this topic because it's interesting to me. But I just think that it's a lot of window dressing, largely. I think most of them really ultimately love the U.S., or at least they don't hate it enough to relinquish their citizenship, that's for sure. And they most of them have homes here.
Well, I agree with you that if you read the international hype of these people who supposedly have, you know, international street cred like Berwick, I don't really think he does, but he claims to have it, you would think that Occam's razor or the laws of physics no longer apply when you leave the United States.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like,
how did that happen? Do you mean there's no gravity in Belize?
Yeah, great point. I know. It's complete lawlessness there. I mean, there's a lot of lawlessness, but let me just mention something else. I mean, and please make your point about Occam's razor, because I love that. But, you know, everybody I interview, it seems like, from these various countries, whether it be Central, South America, you know what I always hear? Their Skype connection stinks. They always say something like, oh, well, the power went out for an hour this morning, so I had to reschedule the interview. Uh-huh. I mean, this is really? You think this is so great? Are you kidding me?
Wow, I love that.
And as far as the real estate deals, they're just not that good as far as I mean, look, I've been to 74 countries. I'm leaving for Europe tonight. I don't know, man. I think the U.S. is a lot better than most people care to admit.
Well, you know, you're almost summarizing an article I wrote after I was exhausted writing about this deal. I just wanted to write a four-paragraph article telling people, you know, guys, a plane ticket and a rental cabana anywhere in the world is gonna get you what you need. You don't have to get involved in the tar pit of a land development deal, you know, 6,000 miles away.
Yeah,
I mean, I was amazed with a buddy of mine. We were down there for 21 days, and all we did is purchase a plane ticket. I mean, as exotic as you think going to Chile is, it's not. You can do it the instant you decide you can, and you just buy a plane ticket.
Yeah, right.
And then, son of a gun, if you don't just rent somewhere, I was renting for, you know, four times less than I pay for my mortgage in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm in Chile with a plane ticket. I'm renting. I could rent, you know, in perpetuity, theoretically, and pay less than I'm paying now.
Yeah, right.
And all I've done is rent. I've got no commitments. I've done nothing.
I know. It's so easy. Yeah, it's a much better choice. And even if you look at, you live in Northern California, you're in the Napa Valley area, okay? So, I mean, even if you said, hey, I'm going to move to Phoenix or LA, I would advise you to rent first so you can figure out what area of the city you like, you know?
Absolutely.
That's just wise advice for anybody. You don't have to dive in with both feet and change your whole life and put down hundreds of thousands of dollars on something.
Yes, you know, and that's the ironic conclusion that I came to with most places. I lived in a rent control apartment in Hollywood for 14 years.
Yeah, and that's an awfully good deal. Rent control, it's a terrible idea, but it's a great deal for the tenant.
yes. And I actually had to bribe a guy to get in there because he was, you know, anyway, I had to bribe a guy in. It was the best deal of my life. I'll probably never make a better real estate deal. And you know what's interesting is I look back at that 14 years of my life, and you know what they called me? A resident. Mm-hmm. You know who a person who rents, you know, and in Hollywood they're very interested in having a Nevada residency, but actually living in California.
Yeah.
And I used to tell them, what do you call somebody who rents a condo in Las Vegas? You call them a resident.
Okay.
So stop getting caught up in having to own some. Every time you read a magazine, you have to own something in the south of France. You don't.
Let me tell you. I love that you're saying this because it's so true. I've almost all of my life been a homeowner, and I own a lot of income property. Okay, mm-hmm. all around the country, scattered all around the country in different mm-hmm. states and cities. And you know, I've owned apartments, single family homes, all of that good stuff. I've had hundreds of tenants over the years. I think real estate as income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world. Okay, mm-hmm. but I rent my own place because mm-hmm. especially if you're renting a high-end place, the rent-to-value ratio is so skewed in favor of the tenant and against the landlord. It's just such a better deal. You know, there's this huge delta yeah. between the price and the rent mm-hmm. when you, especially when you go to the higher end. Okay, now if you're yep. if you're going to live in a $150,000 house, I think you should probably own that house that you live in, mm-hmm. okay? But mm-hmm. you look at the mobility factor, the fact that, you know, the job market's somewhat anemic. The best thing you can have on a resume is mobility, you know? Be able to yes. move, you know? If you're tied down with a house, I mean, I think you should own yep. property as an investment mm-hmm. for sure, but you don't need to mm-hmm. own the place you live. And I'll tell you, one of the metaphors for this, I think, was really well said by the pastor, Tim Timmons, when I mm-hmm. was sitting in church one day many years ago. And he said, and this was in Southern California, and he was talking about materialism in Orange County, California. Imagine that, you know, such a materialistic place for sure. And he was talking about materialism and explaining that, look, we're all just trustees. We get to control things from birth to death, and that's it. We're all, and in other words, we're all renters. Okay, you don't really own anything.
Oh my gosh, you're just music to my ears yeah. here. I have a couple of phrases to try to encapsulate this and impart that bit of wisdom to people. Mm-hmm. I say, so, you know, Ted Turner sits around with however many hundreds of thousands of acres in Montana. But all that really happened was when people say that they own land is you take documents from one filing cabinet, move it to another,
yeah.
and then everybody pretends they're an owner. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, I know. It's
well, here I was in this rent control apartment for 14 years. I had accumulated three houses, and I was on the, you know, buy houses and the John Schwab making it big on little deals.
Well, hey, that's good advice, though. I think that's good. Yeah.
I met John Schwab. Couldn't say enough about it. I love the guy. And here I am. But when I was dating, here's my funny story. I'm dating, and I would go out with a woman, and I'd bring her back to my what I thought was a lovely rent control apartment. You know, and you could see her face kind of drop a little bit. And she thought, geez, you really seem to be a much more successful guy. I have a lot more going on. Now, depending on how it was going with them, I usually would not tell them because I thought, wow, okay, let's see where this goes. They have no idea. You know, I didn't want to say, well, yeah, I own lots of houses, but what does that have to do with me? I mean, I don't need a house. I'm a bachelor.
Right, yeah.
I've got this beautiful grand piano in the living room. I've got my computer set up. I've got a wonder, you know, this is all I need. Why would I need to own this? Anyway, it's just funny when people...
Yeah, I know. It really is. It really is. Yeah, it's very interesting. Okay, good. Well, what else do you want the listeners to know about Galtz Gulch or just the international expat concept in general?
Okay.
Now, listen, all of this said, folks, I mean, I would still like to have a second passport just in case someday I need it. Maybe it would allow me to travel some different places or something. I don't know. You know, I don't really exactly know what the benefits are. But there's a lot of scams in that world. But I'm just saying I wouldn't mind having one. Everything, I mean, you should know about the world. Certainly, maybe you have options in case things go bad in whatever country in which you reside. But just be really careful. There's so many scam artists out there because there's nobody really has jurisdiction over them. Mm-hmm. They know how to play the game that I guess Doug Casey was probably the first guy that outlined it mm-hmm. in The International Man, where he said, have your money in one jurisdiction, have your life in another, have your passport in another, have entities in a fourth, that kind of concept. And you can't get these guys because they're just immune. They don't really have a jurisdiction. Well, so that's very dangerous to be dealing with someone you don't really have good recourse against.
Absolutely. Well, you and I were just talking about the benefits of being a renter. Let's just extend that into what you just said. I found that you can't beat being a visitor wherever you are. And therefore, I did move forward in getting second passports for my family. We did actually achieve that goal. But I didn't necessarily want to get a second passport for them in the country I thought we would end up. I wanted them to still be visitors in Chile.
Okay.
But we ended up getting Colombian passports.
Okay. And are they real? Are they fake? You know, a lot of those are fake. You got to be careful.
Yes, they are real. I don't have one, but my.
Have you used them? I mean, have you really used them through a passport control? You know?
My wife used hers and my two sons. They're 6 and 2. They've used them. It's funny because I was the big booster in getting second passports. And I'm the one who got the 2-year residency card, and they got the actual, documents.
Yeah. Interesting.
But even so, I would prefer, what I told my wife is, look, honey, if anything happens, what I'd prefer is we go down there to Colombia for however long we want to. We have family down there. I probably know more about Colombia than I do Chile. And then if we feel the need, which I think we should feel the need, we'll continue on to Chile, and then it'll be optimal because we'll have South American passports, but we won't be citizens of the country that we reside. To turn this around on its head, to give you the benefits, I think it would be, I believe that the illegal aliens that come across the border in Texas from wherever they come from.
You mean as Hillary Clinton said, the workers without papers? The illegal aliens is really a politically incorrect, very mean thing to say. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for your correction.
I'm obviously being snarky, but yeah.
Well, my theory, and I think I can prove this, I do in my book here, is where I say that I think you can have an illegal alien, whatever the new phrase is, undocumented workers. They can T-bone a car full of nuns and small children, kill them all, God forbid. And the policeman comes, he doesn't know what to do with them because they haven't opted into any of the jurisdictional adhesion contracts.
Hmm, that's interesting.
They end up being strangely untouched. Now, I say strangely, but I no longer think it's strange. I think it's just that they have no driver's license, they have there's no documents. They haven't opted into the jurisdiction. And until they do, which is my explanation, by the way, for why all of the free licenses were given out to undocumented workers, let's say, they want to give them free licenses because they need their signature on some kind of jurisdictional opt-in.
Mm.
Now, let me turn this all the way around to what you were saying before, you know, the benefits of renting, but don't necessarily be a citizen in the country that you're at. You get the same benefits if you are renting a hotel, any country that you'd like to be for the next 2 weeks. You are renting and you're not a citizen. You have opted into none of the standard state adhesion contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good place to be. Now, I think like yourself and myself, I'm gonna be the same gentleman I am here, whatever country I'm in. I'm going to be very polite.
You're not going to be the ugly American. Yeah, good.
No. All I have to do to not be the ugly American is speak one syllable of the second language or even have the first passport.
Except in France, because there you'll always be considered the ugly American. Okay. They're not going to like you no matter what.
You can speak perfect French to them, and I've seen it happen, and they'll still scowl at you. But yeah, anyway, so I don't know if we're getting too far off track, but I have a very brief list that I think are good lessons from Gulch Chile.
Okay, yeah, please, let's get on that. Good.
On my second article, The Creature from Gulch, I think it's extremely...
Yeah, paraphrasing G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Yeah. Hey, he's been on the show a couple of times. He's great.
Oh, he's fantastic. I've learned a lot from him. I think it's very important that the sophisticated people or just human beings... learn about this creature called psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
I know the term is all the rage, but I mean it in the literal sense. I mean, you can get the Robert Hare checklist of psychopathy, and you can go through it and ask yourself, am I seeing one of these creatures here? And now in Johnson's case, I've got just dozens of eyewitnesses that say, yep, total sociopath. So, and I think it's very important to learn to recognize it. And here's what I'll do for the listener. There is a YouTube video called I, Psychopath, which is an excellent documentary. And you can follow one around for an hour and you can see how they act. Try to get familiar with that type of person. They have their ways. And if you can just...
So it's a film, what is it, a documentary?
BBC documentary called I, Psychopath.
I, Psychopath. Okay, yeah. I got to look that up. That's very
interesting. Just Wikipedia, the Robert Hare checklist. And if you have a suspicion...
Robert Hare?
Dr. Robert Hare.
How do you spell Hare?
H-A-R-E.
Okay.
Try to get that checklist. It's on Wikipedia. And if the hair in the back of your neck stands up, or you just can't understand why up is down and down is up when you're dealing with certain people, go down that checklist and try to think if you may be dealing with one. It's only 1% to 3% of the population.
Okay.
Most people don't have experience with them. But if that person could have been eliminated from Gulch Gulch Chili, there was plenty of money to make a great development deal happen. And it was it was all brought to its knees by one psychopath. And I say that with full knowledge that I'm not a psychiatrist, but with lots of interviews and lots of study, lots of checklists. I think we've got one on our hands there, and he ruined the deal down there.
Interesting. Okay. I'm loving this checklist, by the way. The first one is superficial charm. And I got to tell you something, folks, people who are con artists are really nice, friendly, generous people. Mm-hmm. And when you steal from others, it's kind of easy to be generous because you usually have a lot of money, okay? And you didn't actually have to earn that money in a real way, so you can afford to be very generous because there was no real cost in acquiring that money to you. And so they tend to buy people, and they're always buying dinner, they're always buying drinks. You know, they're always the generous one, right? And they're always really nice. They're like the nicest people. And, you know, people can't realize that is the stock and trade of a con artist, is they're nice, you know?
Well, what I like to say is that the psychopath and the socialist have one thing in common. They both run out of other people's money very quickly.
Great. Great point. Yeah, it's a Margaret Thatcher takeoff. Yeah. You know, the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money, but that's great. Yeah.
Okay, the second thing on my checklist is we've all heard about this unicorn of a loyal title. I think there are some places left on the earth where you can actually own land without a superior landlord, that is the state. Just at least try to give it a shot to find
In other
it.
Words, everybody has a perpetual lien on their property because it's called property taxes.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's independent of any superior landlord. That's what a loyal title means. It's an old title related to the land ownership by occupancy and defense of the land.
Now, okay, so what countries don't have some sort of ongoing tax like that? Do you know offhand?
There are countries where that's been completely wiped out. The United States, if you can believe it, still has little places left.
Really?
They are, but here's why people don't know that. Because in the United States, they're referred to as federal land patents.
Hmm.
And so people are Googling perhaps a loyal title, and then they can't find anything. And they go, oh, this doesn't exist. Well, try federal land patent, and you'll get a little bit more information. Now, I don't want to get your hopes up. But what I'm saying is you can at least give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because what you're purchasing, as you know, Jason, in the United States, if you read the thing, it's fee simple title, and it even says it's a lease. You're purchasing a lease. So when people walk around the United States saying, I own this house, they're using a conventional phrase to try to convey what they've done with a piece of land. In point of fact, if you look at the legalities of it, they are now a fee simple title holder of lot number whatever that gives them, a lease with that particular state.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the realities of it. I don't want to be disparaging about it, but I want to, you know, the first way to get free here is to start using words correctly.
Very interesting. Okay.
In Gulch Gulch Chili, though, they didn't take title into the name of a person, but into the name of an entity. Well, once you take a title in the name of an entity, you have asked the state to form an entity. And you're now under the auspices of the state, whether you like it or not. So everything you do with a piece of land owned in a corporation, you're kidding yourself if you think having taken title in the name of a corporation, you can now remove the state from your deal. Mm-hmm. You've invited the state in to be the deal.
That's an interesting take on entities. Wow, I've never heard that kind of take. So what you're saying is don't use entities because you've sort of given the state license to interfere with your ownership?
Yes, you've asked them to interfere. Huh. And this happens with 501(c) churches. Once they opt in to that entity, which is a corporation, 501(c), it's just a type of a corporation.
Yeah.
Once they take title to their church land in that 501(c), they have opted in to all sorts of adhesion contracts that they will later complain about. But the problem is that their signature is in that opt-in. Now, I'm not saying this is easy, but I'm saying the first way out of this is to understand what's actually occurring. So what I would say to do, hey, if you can find a loyal title or in the United States, a federal land patent, do it. Mm-hmm. There are two lawyers in this country, and they would that could accomplish this task. And I believe it's so complicated, I think they would both have to talk to each other to accomplish it. But at least try. Mm-hmm. The second thing is
do you want to say where those properties are? Do you know?
No, I don't really want to talk more about it. It gets complicated. And I don't think people can.
Yeah, we're running long already. But okay, go ahead.
Let's move on to the third thing. The third thing is, if you're gonna decide to put land into an entity, at least try to shift the liability into the entity itself, which is the purpose for entities anyway.
Right.
Yeah. And away from the leaseholders. As a matter of fact, with developments such as Gulch Chile, I'd say, okay, you take title in a corporation, put all the liability in that corporation just like the multinationals do, and make the ownership into long-term leases for the landholders. So instead of saying, hey, I sold him a lot, don't sell him a lot. Just tell him up front, dude, I want to shield you from liability, and I'm going to sell you a 99-year lease that's renewable, and you're buying a lease. If you want to change the price, build that into the supply and demand price, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah. The problem with that is, you have interesting ideas here, but in practicality, like, you're not going to be able to finance that property very well. The lenders won't like the lease aspect. It's just, but conceptually, and from a very macro picture, I get it. Yeah, interesting.
Well, I think you're right, but when you relate that to Gulch Chile, they purchased the first property for $1.2 million outright. They didn't have any loans. So they were in a position to do that.
Right. But maybe they want to refinance it later.
Yeah.
You know, who knows,
yeah.
Right?
I'm not saying it's easy, and I understand. Now, the last thing, the final thing, is I would say 1 Corinthians 6, and I say this regardless of anybody's beliefs. When you escalate a disagreement between a brother or a friend or a business person to the state, you've got to understand that you have just escalated the matter to your inferior.
That's an interesting point, too. Yeah, okay.
You can't expect to get a superior result by escalating to an inferior entity. And when you get involved into a court situation, think about, I understand it's hard to swallow the money you might have lost. I know that maybe you thought that this was the agreement and you're losing a friend, or you're in some situation where you just think you're being wronged. As hard as that is, if you escalate to the state, you are escalating to your inferior, and you are going to lose money. You're going to give money to lawyers. You're going to lose everything you were clinging to in the first place. So, I mean, to a Christian, I would say don't escalate your brothers or sisters to law.
Well, here's the deal with litigation most of the time, folks. First, you get burned by the other party. They steal from you, basically, or screw you over in some way. And then you get burned and screwed over by your own lawyer after that. that's pretty much the way litigation works most of the time, unfortunately. Not to say that I don't engage in it. That's the way it works, you know, most of the time. I mean, I'm hunting down. I got a case right now where I'm suing who I believe is a crooked property manager in Kansas City, Missouri. So many people have come forth because of that case and said that he's cheated or cheating them currently too. I don't know. I kind of feel like sometimes it's just your solemn duty, but yeah, you are escalating it to the state, and you never know what's going to happen. And
I'm not saying world. That people who have done that. Yes, you know, there's been times when I've been tempted, and I'm not in any way going to disparage people who have no choice. If you do have a choice,
yeah.
You know,
try to avoid it whenever possible. That's good advice. Yeah,
these are the kinds of tips. I'm writing this book to my sons. They're only 6 and 2, but I'm writing it. My ideal reader is them in their 20s.
Great.
And I just feel this desperate need to tell them all of these tricks that we've been discussing in all areas of their lives, because I think in the future, we tend to criticize outliers now. We break them down and we discard them from the statistical sample. But I think in the future, and sometimes in the present, you've got to take the outlying data points, and instead of discarding them, you have to say, well, how did you succeed? You're totally outside of every norm, but you know, nobody's touching you and you seem to be succeeding. And you could say something like, well, you've got to listen to Jason Hartman's podcast, because we told you that that if you want to succeed and be an outlier, you'd be renting, not owning in Belize.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you would be not opting into the state's adhesion contracts by feeling the need to be a citizen of that country. Why not just be a visitor of that country? And most people would say, well, that takes away all of my sense of security. And you can tell them, well, if you really need that sense of security, then you're not going to have it. You're better off renting or not being a citizen, or, you know, any such number of combinations of things spread across all the areas of your life.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Good stuff. Well, Terrence, this is fascinating. Did you finish that, by the way?
I'm almost done with the first volume.
Oh, okay.
It's like 800. Yeah.
Cool. Give out your website one more time, if you would.
It's mickgillespie.com. So it's M-C Gillespie, G-I-L-L-E-S-P-I-E.com.
Where do you get the Mick from?
I went to a bar in Ireland in the year 2000 when my father had died, and I looked, I couldn't believe it, you know, with this name Gillespie all my life, and there was just a beautiful wooden sign that said Mick Gillespie.
Okay.
And I thought, you gotta be kidding me, all this time I've been a Mick.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I got it, yeah, and you really just go by Gillespie, though. Yeah, okay, I got it. Good
well,
stuff.
Well, also, it's my father, so I'm the son of my father, right. A way to honor my father who passed away in 2000.
Ah, got it, good stuff. Okay, well, any closing thoughts? Let's just wrap this up. This has been a long and winding discussion, but it's been fascinating.
Okay, well, the story goes everywhere, Jason. It just keeps unraveling. I hope there's going to be restoration for the owners, but at least we can maybe via this podcast provide some tips for future such deals. But we could talk forever about this project, but I think we've said
it. We sure could. Terrence Gillespie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.